All of everything I've said so far, this will be by far the most important thing, which is how to compute some contour integral if you have some poles inside. So if we have some analytic some function with some pole singularities inside some contour gamma, the integral around gamma is the sum of the residues of the function inside the contour. Okay? Yes? If you wind twice that curve, I will get twice the integral, so twice the number of residues. Right. Okay? So whatever asked was, if we go around twice, then of course the integral is twice as big. Now, let me mention an obvious extension of this. If I have not a closed curve, but some integral, say along some line parallel to the real axis, but below the real axis, and then going back along some curve above the real axis, if the function f of z, which I'm integrating, decreases fast enough at infinity, I can always pretend that I close, and then I am again in a closed contour case. So again, this integral around this curve, and then coming back along this line, would be equal to the sum of residues of f inside the strip gamma, where the strip gamma would be this region. Okay? Everything is clear, I hope, right? So I apologize for those who... Okay. Let's go through some of the examples of the exercises, even though it might look a bit too obvious now that we thought a bit about it, but let me still mention it. One of the problems was to compute the integral around some in some curve, in this case just a circle, of 1 over x squared plus 1. And x squared plus 1 has two poles, one at minus I, one at plus I. So there is a smart way of computing it, but let's do it using the left board. So what is the residue of this function at plus I? So at plus I, 1 over x squared plus 1, which is equal to 1 over x minus I, x plus I. At I, this factor here is just 2i, and therefore the residue is equal to the residue of f at x equal to I is equal to 1 over 2i. Okay? Some people wrote that the residue was 1. No. I don't know what was the logic, but it's of course 1 over 2i. What would be the residue of f at x equal minus I? When x is equal to minus I, this is the pole, and this guy becomes minus 2i. So it's minus 1 over 2i. Right? F behaves as 1 over 2i times 1 over x minus I, and f behaves as minus 1 over 2i times 1 over x plus I. So these are the residues. So the sum of the two residues is equal to 0. Yet another way, and many of you did it in this way, would be just to notice that 1 over x squared plus 1 is equal to 1 over x minus I minus 1 over x plus I with a factor of 1 over 2i. And of course, this contribution from this pole cancels with this pole, and we don't even need to figure out what exactly this constant is. And this against this means we'll give that the integral of f will be 0. There is a more obvious way, an even faster way of doing this, which is just to notice that there are no poles inside. So I can just blow the contour and make the contour larger and larger and send just this contour to infinity, and at infinity the function decays and there is no contribution. The function decays as 1 over x squared. So it is more, even more obviously 0, because we can blow gamma to infinity. And just open the contour, goes to infinity, there are no poles outside, So it just goes, it just vanishes, and if the function vanishes, that's 1 over x squared, and 1 over x squared is what we need. We need decays at 1 over 3 squared to be able to blow the contours. Okay, so because it decays very fast at infinity, I can just blow the contour and use the fact that there are no poles outside the circle to conclude that the result is 0. If the function would not decay as fast, if there would be, say, an x here, for example, then it would only decay as 1 over x, and I might tell you that you would not have the right to blow the contour because it doesn't decay as fast. In fact, you do have the right, but you have to take into account what is called a residue at infinity, a pole at infinity, which you would see by changing variables to from x to 1 over x. Okay, but I think this is a detail. If some of you want to know more about how to deal with residue, how to deal with blowing the contour if the function doesn't decay as fast as it looks like, you can ask me during the break and I will tell you. But otherwise, for now, if the function decays fast enough, you can always blow the contour to infinity. In particular, in this case, by doing so, we avoid even thinking about what are the values of the residues. Is this clear? No? Is that not? It's not clear? Whether it is clear. What I said. Yeah? For example, what is the value of the integral around the absolute value of z equal to some 2 again? 1 over x cubed plus 1 again. Again, there are some poles which are at minus 1 and a triangle of unit radius, right? So there are the roots of unity. But of course, this is zero because again, we can blow the contour to infinity. Right? It decays fast enough, and I don't need to decompose and to compute all the residues inside. So this is something typical. If I have a situation where I have some poles inside and some poles outside, normally, even if there are poles outside the contour, I decide to blow the contour if the number of poles outside is smaller than the number of poles inside. Right? So if I would have this function now, for example, the integral around the absolute value of z equal to 2. 1 over x cubed plus 1 times 1 over x minus 4i, for example. What would be the value of this dx over 2 pi I? What is the value of this integral? Zero? No. No, not zero. Exactly. So now we are integrating here. We have three poles here, which are the poles minus 1, e to the 2 pi I over 3, e to the minus 2 pi I over 3. Right? These are the points where x cubed is equal to minus 1. I hope. But in any case, they are inside the circle, so I don't care. Is it correct? It's not, right?
No,
just pi over 3. Okay, now I cubed it and it's okay. And then there is one more pole here, outside this contour, at 4i. So I can again blow the contour, but when blowing the contour, I need to pick. I'm now increasing, blowing the contour here. But then I need to pick this pole as I am increasing it. So at the end of the day, I get this was the original contour, and then I get something like, if I want to integrate here, I would have to take this pole into account. It was the original three guys, and this goes like this. And this, of course, then I can decide to chop this part, and I'm left with that part there, just that integral around that pole, and the rest I can now blow to infinity. And this integral here, it's equal, let's see, to now I have this contribution here. So all this is just equal to the integral around this point like this. Okay, around this point for I. And what is the residue at for I? We expand the function at for I. The part x cubed plus 1 is perfectly regular, so I just replace by 4i. So the function f of z behaves as 1 over 4i cubed plus 1 times 1 over x minus 4i. So this part here is the residue, which is equal to minus 1 over, who knows how to make 4 cubed? 4 cubed is 16 times 4, which is 64. 64 minus 1, 63. Minus 1 over 63. And the orientation is the opposite as usual. It's not the one we need to compute the residue. Normally we need counterclockwise, right? We need this orientation to say that it's the sum of residues. So this is equal to minus, there is already the 2 pi I, so I just need minus residue of F. So it is equal 1 over 63.
Y cube is minus I.
I cube is minus I, so this is wrong. Okay, excellent. Minus 64i plus 1, and here I get 1 over, I get minus 1 over minus 64i plus 1. Okay? So this is the value of that integral there. So I hope all these manipulations, this is what you should be very good and you should do it instinctively, without thinking much. It's just blow counter, pick this ball. All these manipulations should become really absolutely trivial for you. Good. Let me make two more comments before moving to the applications, as I said, which, as I said, will be the main focus of today. So, one comment, it related still to this residue stuff. It was another of the problems. If I have an integral around some contour gamma, of the derivative with respect to z of log of some polynomial t of z dz over 2 pi I. Now, my claim is that this is equal to the number of zeros with degeneracy. That is, if it's a double zero, I count it twice. Inside gamma, number of zeros of P of Z, of the polynomial P of Z. Why is this true? Because close to a zero, because indeed, close to a zero, the derivative with respect to z of log of p of z is equal to the derivative with respect to z of log. Now the polynomial goes to zero, so there is some constant a, and then z minus the value where the polynomial is zero to the power of the degeneracy. So this is equal to 1 for simple poles. Simple zeros. And A is absolutely irrelevant, and I just get G over X over Z minus Z star, which implies that the residue is just equal to the degeneracy. So let's call this integral capital N. Capital N is equal to the sum over the zeros z star, the degeneracy of the zero z star, which is precisely what I said. Finally, the last comment I would like to make concerns the discontinuity of functions in Riemann surfaces, like the discontinuity of square roots. So as we said, A square root or a log is a perfectly defined function that it has no cuts, no jumps, nothing. It just lives on a Riemann surface, right? So it's like going in a parking lot, as I said, and you go to the second floor, you go to the third floor. In which floor you are doesn't make much sense. This is a question of the engineers, how they decide to paint the floors and to change color from red to blue. Now, but there is a well-defined question, which is, suppose I am in a given floor, and I want to measure the distance to someone who is exactly below me, in the other floor. I want to know how high the floors are in this parking lot. So this is something well-defined. And this is what I will call the discontinuity function. So let's be more precise. Suppose I have the function log of z, for example. Log of z, typically we say that there is a cut, but as we say, this is our choice. We can put however we want, going up to zero. Now, if I start here, and I go to this point, or if I start here, and I decide to go here, now let me change color, and go to this point, we know that when I arrive, I am in different sheets. Right? Doesn't matter what is the color or what they are, but I am in the different floors of my parking lot. And the well-defined quantity at this point is the discontinuity of log of z, which is a function defined as log of z going in this path minus log of z by going in the other path. Okay? And what is the value of this function? It's just 2 pi I in the case of the log. It's the constant function. This means that the parking lot which the log function defines has always constant height. The difference between the sheets is always constant and it is 2 pi I. Yes? There?
Yes.
No, it's a polynomial. If it's a polynomial, the derivative of log of a polynomial is a rational function. So it's already a ratio. Sorry?
It only works for polynomials?
It also works for analytic functions without other kind of singularities. So if you have a function that only has zeros, then it also works. And even if there would be, if it would be a rational function, then close to a pole and not a zero, this g would be negative. It would be the only difference. So in general, so let me write then, okay, if you want. If p of z is replaced by r of z, now this is a rational function, then n is the number of zeros minus the number of poles. It counts the number of zeros, and the number of poles, it counts with a minus sign because g is minus 1. Okay, good. So this function is 2 pi I, and again, this is some function of z, which is defined, I want to emphasize it, everywhere. So, not only on this wiggly stuff. Normally, we wrongly, but pragmatically, we often say that at the cut there is a 2 pi I discontinuity, and when we go here and when we come here, when we are at the two sides of the cut, there is a difference of 2 pi I. It's not only on the cut, it's everywhere. Okay? As I showed you here. Another way of thinking is, think that you define the discontinuity on the cut. Suppose you defined it on the cut. Now you defined it on line. Now you can analytically continue to whatever you want. So you can always think of a discontinuity function. If you like cuts so much, okay, define it on a cut. But then this defines a function on a segment. And now you know that function on segments, you can analytically continue. So think that you defined it on the cut. On the cut, the discontinuity will be 2 pi I. Now analytically continue 2 pi I, it gives 2 pi I everywhere. Okay? And if the discontinuity will be some more complicated function, for example, for the square root function, the discontinuity is the square root itself. And this defines a function which is defined not only on the cards, but everywhere else. Okay? Good. So now let me move to applications. I want to consider quantum mechanics. And I will use this blackboard to make a table of predictions that we will then check with mathematics or checks that we want to do. And our goal now is to explore the theory and list here a couple of tests that we will want to do later with Mathematica. So let me start by writing Schrödinger equation. And now we'll do just a bit of quantum mechanics. One-dimensional quantum mechanics, the most trivial thing. So let's just consider the Hamiltonian to be, but it's most trivial, but to get h-bars right, I still need my notes. Actually, it was obvious. Okay. Minus h by square over 2m d square dx square plus v of x minus energy. Let me just write Schrödinger equation acting on psi equal to 0. Okay, good. So, okay, great. So, So now let me define a useful quantity, which is called the quasi-momenta. Which is defined by parameterizing my wave function as exponential of I over h bar integral up to x of p of x dx. This is the quasi-momentum p of x. In other words, you define p of x as the log derivative of the wave function, so h bar over I psi prime over psi, which is, of course, h bar over I, derivative with respect to x of log of the wave function. Okay? Probably you have already seen this quantity. This appears in condensed matter when you have periodic crystals. It appears in double KV approximation in quantum mechanics. But here we are defining it in general. Just a different parameterization of the wave function. I'm not doing any double KV approximation or anything. Okay? You have all seen this formula in one way or another, right? Good. Now, okay, so how does Schrödinger equation look like for this new parameterization? So Schrödinger equation becomes what's called a Riccati equation, an equivalent differential equation with a funnier form. It's nonlinear, and it's of the form p square minus I h bar p prime equals to 2m e minus b. Okay, so if you plug p, what p is in terms of the wave function, you check that this gives precisely Schrödinger equation. Or if you plug the wave function inside Schrödinger, this is what you get. Okay? Good. Who has seen this equation before? No one else? Okay. This is also useful in Iconal approximation. Okay. Anyways, it's not really important. Now, let's see what do we know about p of x. So, for the nth excited state, so let's consider potentials. We will be considering potentials of some sort like this. Here will be some energy level. Now, for the nth excited state, psi, which we can, for the nth excited state, denote psi n as n zeros. Right? It's the basic quantum mechanics fact. So the ground state has zero nodes, the first excited state has one node, etc. Okay? What does it imply for p of x? How do I translate this condition for p of x? What's the analog of this condition for p of x? N zeros in the real axis, sorry. In the real axis. This is important. What does it translate for P of X?
Zero.
look at P of x and say, if psi has a 0, what happens to P of x? Close to a 0 of the wave function. Sorry? It has a pole. It's exactly what we saw before for the polynomial. For a 0 of psi, this P has a pole. What's the residue of the pole? Sorry? No. No. I'm not sure I heard correctly. That's the last one. Sorry? No. Okay, but let's write what we know already. So this means that P of x has n poles. And now I want the residue. With residue equal to, sorry? Yeah, it's a simple pole. These zeros are always simple. Sorry? One almost, exactly. It has residue h bar over I. Right, again, it's exactly the same stuff. Close to a zero, let's look, close to a zero. Right, this is a bracket, p of x behaves as h bar over I, derivative with respect to a, of a times z minus z star. This is the wave function being zero. And a is absolutely irrelevant with, when we take, sorry, log of this. A is absolutely irrelevant, right? It's log of a plus log of this. And the second term gives just h bar over z minus z star. H bar over I. So the residue is h bar over I. Okay? Yes?
Why is it true that Psi has those n zeros?
It's just some quantum mechanics fact. You have the ground state, right? The ground state is the wave function without any zero. Then you have the first excited state, which is the state which has one zero. And you can show that all these wave functions are orthogonal.
That's not for any potential, right? It's
no, I said for this potential. Bounded potential. For this potential. This is the evaluation.
You mean like Wells?
Yes. Good. So P of x has n poles with residue h bar over I. So now, this means that if you have your zeros of your wave function, which are poles of P of x, this will be 1, 2, up to n, the integral around those zeros, the integral dx over 2 pi h bar p of x dx is equal to the number of zeros. Right? Each of them has residue h bar over I, so this quantity here is equal to n. Okay? On the other hand, let's consider classical limits. Let's consider the classical limits, where h bar goes to zero, and therefore from the Picard equation you get that p is approximately equal to what we define as p classical, which is defined as 2m p minus z square root. On the other hand, this is how p looks like in the classical limits. You can draw this h bar. If you want, you are considering highly excited states, the energy is large, and p is just given by the square root by solving this equation. So what's happening now? So in this classical limit, what you have is the square root cut between the values where energy is equal to v and here another point where energy is equal to V. These two points here. Okay? So we got from poles to a cut. What happened? What happened was a condensation of poles. You got more and more and more and more poles, up to a point where these poles formed a continuous line, and this is this cut which is appearing here. So what happened was that we had many zeros, they become even more zeros, and this becomes just a straight line as n is increasing. I'm getting really a dense distribution of zeros, some continuous line. What is the integral around this cut of the function p of x? Integral around the cut of dx over 2 pi h bar p classical is equal to n. This was this condition here in the classical approximation. And this is equivalent to telling you that the integral dx over 2 pi h bar from one turning point to the other in case of these symmetric polynomials, square root of 2m e minus v equal to n. And this is just Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. Okay? That's basically the fastest way of deriving Bohr-Sommerfeld as understanding it as the fact that we must have this quantization condition for the residues of this p of x. And in the classical limit, this p of x just becomes the classical momentum. Okay, actually I did something wrong here. I'm integrating above the cut, so I have the value of p. Then I'm integrating below the cut, the value is opposite, but the orientation is also opposite, so there is a factor of 2 here. Okay, if I want to convert that integral, which is a contour integral, just into a line integral from one point of the square root to the other. Okay, I integrate above, I integrate below, the contribution is double. Okay. This will be how we will derive Bohr-Sommerfeld semiclassical quantization just using some basic complex analysis. This is still too fancy. Let's do harmonic oscillator. Okay? So, any questions so far? Let's focus on harmonic oscillator and let me show you what is the fastest way of deriving the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator without the pain, of course, of solving differential equations, and without the relative pain of fixing normalizations of creation and annihilation operators, which is, of course, much better than differential equations, but still involves all the square roots with 2 pi h bar and whatever. So let's consider V to be m omega square over 2. I never know if it's... Is it like this? Yeah, great. M x square, of course. Okay? So this is V here. So at large, so now I want to know p of x at large x. What's the behavior of p of x at large x? Okay? So I go to this equation and I see how does this equation behave at large x. So this term here behaves as x squared. Right? So what do I need for p? How does p need to behave? So the right-hand side, let's call this equation this symbol here. The right-hand side of this behaves as minus m omega x square plus 2me plus 2me. Right. It doesn't behave. It's equal to. Okay? So what should p? How should p behave at very large x? What should be the behavior of P so that I can match the behavior at large X of the right and the left hand side? Should be linear. Of course, so P should be linear so that when I square it, I get X squared. So P of X must behave as I M omega X. Okay? This, when I square, gives me the first term there on the right-hand side. And what is the correction now? Plus what? What would you put here? Order? What? X is large. Order 1? Order 1 over x? Order 1 over x square? Order what? I'm just plugging here. I have a large x behavior. I'm trying an ansatz for p, which gives the good large x behavior. The linear term is okay. Does everyone agree that the linear term is okay? The x square here cancels with the x square on the left-hand side. Can there be a constant term as the subleading correction? Let's see. If there is a constant term, it's killed by the derivative. It will not appear because of the derivative. It is not on the right-hand side, but it will be on the cross term of p squared, because it will be x times the constant term. Right? So there can be no linear term. There is here 1 over x. So there is no order 1 term. Otherwise, p squared would contain linear term, and there is no linear term to match it with. Okay, this is the behavior of P of X. So we know that P of X is a function which has n poles and which has this behavior at infinity. So what is the most simple guess for a function P of X? This is what we know about the function. We know that we know this box and we know this one here. It's an analytic function with n poles and that behavior at infinity. So can you make a guess for a function? Very simple rational function. What could it be? Let me help. So therefore, there's really no assumption here. P of x is equal to I m omega x plus what? Plus the sum from j equal to n up to n h bar over I 1 over x minus xj. And these are the zeros of psi. And this is a function which behaves, as I said, at infinity and which has this n poles. And it's the analytic function. So let's make this ansatz if you want. Okay? Now, let's match the constant term at x going to infinity of this equation here. What is the constant term from the left-hand side and from the right-hand side? From the left-hand side, so this function here at infinity behaves as I m omega x plus, what's the correction? How does it behave as x goes to infinity? Don't be ashamed. It's when x goes to infinity, how does this function behave? 1 over x. So how does all this behave? Sorry, h bar over I, x, and here? N. Right? So let's use this. This is enough to check the constant term. So from p square, the constant term comes from the mixed term. This guy times this guy. Right? So from p square, you get 2 times I m omega x times h bar over I n over x. from P prime, you get minus I H bar, and then P prime, I M omega. From the right hand side, you get 2 M E. Okay? So this is from P square. This is from minus I H bar P prime. And this is from 2 M E. And this means that the energy is equal to H bar omega N plus 1 half. Okay? Yeah? So as you see, it's really a very economic way of arriving at the result. And, yes?
So, why do we expect this to be sort of true, although you know, this was estimated with large x?
We want to look for an analytic function whose only singularities are a couple of poles, and we know the behavior at infinities. So this is the function we expect. So this is complex analysis is extremely restrictive. There are not many functions. If you know the analytic properties of the function, then there's basically one in practice. Here is what we did. We knew how it behaved at infinity. We know it has some poles. We constructed the natural ansatz, and we get immediately the energy spectrum of the hydrogen atom, of the harmonic oscillator. Okay? With all the factors of H bar and omega, without too much trouble. Now, if we only want the spectrum, we are done. We computed the spectrum, we can move to something else. But suppose I want to know P of x, I want to know the wave function. Then what else do I need to know? What else do I need to compute if I want to know the wave function? I need to compute the zeros. I need to compute the x shape. So now, the next goal is to compute those zeros. So now, we want the x shape. Now, if you look at this equation, if you plug this ansatz into this equation, you see that naively, on the left-hand side, you get a function which has poles when x approaches one of the x's. Right? Because we are plugging something with poles. So the left-hand side, seems to have poles when x goes to x straight. Cannot be, because the right-hand side has no poles, it's a regular function. So, the condition that the residue f xj of the left-hand side is equal to zero is equivalent, if you compute, you just expand and impose that the residue is zero, is equivalent to the following equation, xj is equal to h bar over omega m, sum over k not equal to j up to n, 1 over xi minus x. Okay, it's a set of algebraic equations for this x shape. Now, it's quite funny if you try to interpret what this equation could mean physically. So I'm claiming that, I will claim that this equation can be seen as the equation determining the electrostatic position of two-dimensional particles in a quadratic potential. Okay? This will be the force between the particles. This is the effect of the quadratic potential. And it's curious that to solve the harmonic oscillator, which is in a quadratic potential, we map the problem into finding the electrostatic condition of n charges in a line with a Coulomb, with a quadratic potential. Okay, but for now, this is just an algebraic equation. Any questions so far?
Should that be xk on the bottom?
Sorry?
Should that be xk on the bottom?
Sorry. Xj minus xk. Good, thank you. Now, so indeed, I mean, I should write. So this looks like the electrostatic equilibrium condition for n two-dimensional charges in external x squared potential. So indeed, the potential in two dimensions, the Coulomb potential, is just log of xj minus xk between two particles j and k. So the force between particles I and j is just 1, the derivative of the potential, over xj minus xk. So this equation here, and of course, if you have an external potential which is x squared, the force from this external potential is x. I'm forgetting factors of 2 and stuff like this. 2x, okay, x squared over 2. Then the external force is, would be just x. So we can think as this equation. Can I erase this upper part here? So I want to think as that equation as telling me that some external force acting at the particle which is at position xj is equal, or we can put everything on the same side, plus the sum of the interaction forces felt on this particle by every other particle of xj minus xk is equal to 0. Okay? This is interesting because it gives us a good intuition about what are the solutions to this equation. Right? I mean, if you think of this algebraic equation as it is, you have basically, you don't have a very good intuition about what are the solutions to this algebraic equation. As soon as you think of it in this form, it's absolutely obvious. What happens? Suppose you don't have any interaction. If you don't have any interaction, then you just have some potential, and the particles all want to go to the bottom. They would all be here. And you would have here n particles. This would be without interaction. No interaction. Now, the interaction force is 1 over x is a repulsive force. So this is a repulsive force. So what happens when we turn on the interaction is that instead of going all to the same position, because they repel, they open a bit, and therefore, let this be their position, and therefore, instead of being all here, they open a bit, and they repel, they open, and this will become distributed, and this is because of repulsion. They don't all go to the same position, they open, and they develop this line of zeros because of this repulsion. Okay? So if you give me these zeros, it's very obscure where they would go. Once I think of it in this electrostatic picture way, then it becomes very clear where they go. I'm solving a problem of putting these charges at some given positions, and they have this interaction force. Okay, so the zeros of the wave function of the harmonic oscillator are the position of charges, of one-dimensional charges. Right? This is what we derive. So the zeros of the wave function of the harmonic oscillator are the equilibrium position of two-dimensional charged particles in an x-squared potential. Is this clear to everyone? Yes? Very good. But But there is a solution, there is an exact solution to this equation. And you know that there is. But so far, there is a funny duality, if you want. There is a duality between the zeros of the wave function of the harmonic oscillator and the equilibrium positions of charges, of two-dimensional charges in external harmonic potential. Quite a remarkable duality, if you want. Two seemingly very different quantities turn out to be exactly equivalent. And this is the precise statement, that this equilibrium position means that they solve this equation. Now, this equation has exact solution. You can find the exact position of these charges, or you can at least write it more or less explicitly. What is the solution? What is the exact position of these charges? When I will tell you, you will tell me, oh, okay, obvious. Maybe you can anticipate. What is the exact solution? Well, it's very simple. It's given by, okay, it's still implicit. But they are nothing but the zeros of the Hermit polynomials. Here is the solution. They are the solution, they are the zeros of the Hermit polynomials. Why? Because the wave functions of the harmonic oscillators are an Hermit polynomial times an exponential. And this is precisely what we have here. If you write the prefactor as a polynomial, when you compute p, this polynomial is what gives this part here. And the exponential is what gives this part here. So of course we knew that the zeros of the wave functions of the harmonic oscillator were the zeros of the Hermit polynomial, because the wave functions of the harmonic oscillator are Hermit polynomials. Yes?
Is this the Hermit polynomial with x complex?
No, real x. They are real zeros, as I said. Excited state as x is real zeros. The problem is two-dimensional. The force is two-dimensional, but the particles live in a line. Okay, so they are living in a line. The distribution is in a line. It's along the real axis. And the force is the force that they would feel if they would live in a two-dimensional world. Okay? Okay. I would like you to observe this. So let's make a small pause and think a bit about this, and let's move on. Let's assume we did not know that this was the exact solution. Suppose I give you later some electrostatic equation. What could be the strategy given some electrostatic equilibrium condition of what could be the strategy for finding some polynomial which gives the exact solution to that equilibrium condition? And we will discuss a bit more the kind of things that we discussed. But this might be a bit new, so think a bit about it, and let's resume in a couple of minutes. And if you don't mind, please fill out this survey before. And keep them, because then at the end of the next one, you fill the back part. Do you mind distributing these ones, please? Elizabeth? Okay, there are three. No. Yeah, but there's only two spots. They are occupied.
State has n poles for any V.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For every V.
Yes. It's in Landau. It's in the very beginning of the quantum mechanics. Landau quantum mechanics. I don't remember exactly. Let me see. I probably can remind the argument.
Does V have to be symmetric?
No. But it must be a well. I'm thinking about wells, right, where the spectrum is